From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Look around, and it's obvious. A lot of Americans are having children later in life. 30? Common. 35? Common. 40? Sure, plenty. It's a joy to have family. But have we underestimated the downsides, the difficulties of older child rearing for parents, children, families, society? My guest today has done it, and she's looked around, and she says, yes, we have. We've got some issues here. This hour on Point, the hard part, what a generation of older parents means for family life and American society. You can join the conversation. Is this you? How's it going? And where is it taking us? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Judith Shulevitz, science editor at The New Republic. She had her first child at 39. Now she has two. Loves them to pieces, but she's clear-eyed about it. She wrote the cover story for the latest issue of The New Republic. It's headlined, The Grayest Generation, and How Older Parenthood Will Upend American Society. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Judith, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here.
Upend American society. We thought it was just about, you know, the joy of having babies.
It is about the joy of having babies. Everybody wants babies.
Yeah.
I'm just asking questions about whether it's good for the children, whether we're moving into a world of declining fertility, which is maybe you could argue is good for the environment, but isn't that good for society? We may not produce enough children to replace the workforce as it ages. And I think it's hard on the parents in ways that they wouldn't have predicted when they started, because they're dealing with toddlers and really old parents at the same time.
You're part of this trend, and it's hardly a new trend at this point, but we're deep enough into it that we can look around and maybe begin to see consequences. I mean, there are reasons that men and women have put this off for so long. You must know those reasons very well, Judith.
I do. For one thing, in my career, which is journalism, It wouldn't have even occurred to me to have a child in my 20s. Anyone who did signaled very loudly that they weren't serious about their career. And the men I met weren't serious about settling down and getting married, nor was I. It just didn't really occur to us. And as I grew older, I moved into a higher income bracket, and it was easier to imagine having children. Now, I wouldn't want other women not to have those options. What I'm looking for, I think, is for society to make it more possible for the workforce to change, or the workplace to change, for the government to put in place more family-friendly policies. Because I think that the downsides are starting to become apparent.
So take us through some of those downsides more closely, Judith. I mean, we've seen the parents with their kids and plenty of gray at the temples and the joy that they take in and the pleasure they take in them. But you look around and you see a lot else going on as well. Walk us through some of that.
Well, the reason I wrote this story is because I had a beautiful baby boy at 39, but when he was three, he started manifesting, I should say, very minor fine motor delay and something called sensory integration disorder. And I was advised to take him for occupational therapy, which is essentially a kind of fancy gym. Going to a fancy gym.
And so sounds kind of young for occupational therapy, a three-year-old.
Yes, exactly. It's a whole new profession that involves working with kids.
Okay.
And has its own bizarre vocabulary as well. But so I was the one taking him and sitting outside on these little kid-sized chairs and just thinking and watching the women coming in with their children, who frankly had much more severe problems than my son. I'm glad he didn't have severe problems, but it made me wonder. A lot of these women were a lot older. Was that effect of just living right outside New York City? Or was there something about being an older parent which predisposed your child to have these developmental issues?
You're the science editor. What did you find?
I found that there is actually a rise in diagnoses of developmental delays and developmental problems of autism, schizophrenia is a different issue, But there's always a question about whether there are more diagnoses because people are more aware of it. But it's beginning to look like the rise is absolute, which is to say that it goes above and beyond overdiagnosis. And there are speculations that this is linked to later parenthood, and there are also speculations that this is linked to the fertility industry, which is linked to later parenthood.
The fertility industry, as in assisted reproductive technologies, ART. What's the potential linkage there?
Well, the fertility industry is notoriously underregulated. So one of the things we don't have in this country are outcomes, not just of, you know, successful rates of pregnancy, but what happens to the children afterwards. There are a lot of drugs being used in the process. There are certain processes that I talk about in the article, mm-hmm. in which you inject sperm directly into an egg, which is a process that is looking like it leads to more birth defects than simply in vitro fertilization by itself. Mm. We are learning more in the world of science and genetics about how babies develop and the importance of very early development and how hormones can change that development and how handling reproductive material can change that development. And it's some of the things people are finding, researchers are finding, are a little bit alarming. Increases in rate of birth defects, altered brain architecture, which may be the cause of these neurological issues which are arising, those are linked often to older men's sperm.
These are fertility treatments, Judith, that people start to dip into at what age generally?
Well, I can't say that, you know, young women don't use them. There are a lot of reasons for infertility, mm-hmm. but you are more likely to resort to fertility treatments if you're over 35, when you're fertility declines. If you're a woman, it declines very steeply to below 10%, a 10% rate of pregnancy mm-hmm. per cycle. So you're more likely to resort to these treatments if you delay. And they've been sort of trumpeted as these wonderful resources for women, and I think there are downsides we're only beginning to understand.
So there may be a physical, medical, scientific downside here.
Right.
Let's look on the other side. I mean, you remind us in this piece that in many studies, study after study have shown, as you write, that children of older parents, they grow up in wealthier households, they lead more stable lives, they do better in school. You say, after all, their parents are grown-ups. On the kind of family life and nurturing side, that sounds like major positives.
I think they are. I mean, I think they are for various reasons. I think you need a lot of money to raise a kid in this society, and it's better to have it than not to have it. But part of that is we really leave parents on their own to handle everything, and we don't give a lot of support to those parents. And as another guest who's coming on our show mm-hmm, later pointed out, you know, that's great when the kids are little, but when the kids are older and their parents are much older, they can lose out. Also, when parents die earlier in a young person's life, it's actually harder for them than if they die when they're older. There's a risk that children won't know their grandparents, and that sounds like a minor risk, but
because they're born when the grandparents may be already gone,
or older, mm-hmm. or so old mm-hmm. that they can't really be involved mm-hmm. in their grandchildren's lives the way they might have been before. They can't do the babysitting, the spoiling, the passing on of family traditions. And in a fragmented mobile society where families are sort of and generations are breaking apart already, I think that is actually important, not knowing your grandparents. It's actually a problem.
In terms of learning sort of family lore and traditions and just being connected to the great chain of being.
Right. And also, you know, like I said, we in America don't support families financially and in terms of, you know, government institutions or social institutions very well. Grandparents are an important resource for helping a family with young children cope with the extraordinary pressures. If they're not around, that family is even more on its own.
If the children are born later, you point out, if you start late, you may not have the family of a size that you intended. And that overall, this is lining us up for a baby bust demographically in this country.
That's right. I mean, we in this country are at more or less at replacement rate. That is, we still have more than two children per couple, 2.06 or 0.01, I think. In Europe, in Japan, in many countries, industrialized countries around the world, they're below replacement rate. So more people are dying than are being born, which leads you to these problems with the workforce. Leads you to the question of who's going to support the older generation, how is it going to be paid for. And there, one of the things that happens when your fertility, when as a nation your fertility rate drops below replacement rate, is you actually start putting in place family-friendly policies to try to bring fertility up. And they appear to work. Some of them work better than others. But when countries are worrying about their fertility, they actually do things about it.
So this country may do something about it. In the meantime, we've got a lot of older parents, and some of the emotional bites and nibbles are small, but just people looking, and you say it's happened in your own household, where they're not sure if your husband's been, are you the grandfather or the father? That kind of question.
Right. Right. I mean, another thing that happens, my children are 9 and 10 now, and they say to me, Mom, if I wait as long as you did to have kids, you're going to be approaching 80. What's that going to be like? And I said, what lesson do you draw from that? And they said, have my kids earlier. And I say, bingo.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about America's wave of older parents and what having kids later means for family life and our society. There are advantages, Judith Shulevitz writes in the current New Republic, about some downsides in terms of fertility, consequences of fertility treatment, perhaps, in terms of how the family operates and the relationships between generations when everything starts later. She joins us from New York. Her piece is headlined, The Grayest Generation, Older Parenthood Won't Just Redefine the American Family, It Will Upend Society. Elizabeth Gregory and Nona Willis Aronowitz join us in just a moment. Judith, I want to share with you some of the kind of response we're getting here online. Some people just missed the window. Nancy writes to us. She says, I put off having children, waiting for the right man, right job, enough money, stability. Unfortunately, she writes, my time has just run out. As all other things fell into place, while I can still adopt, this is a tough decision that she's made, waiting, and one she says she could never reverse. And here's one for you, Judith. Bob writes, I'm 53, and my wife, 41. We had our first child, a son, last month. Having a child is such a joy, but I never imagined it would be so much work, and I'm sure it'll be a little rough to toss around a football with him in a few years. However, I'm glad I waited, Bob writes. I was able to have a lot of fun in my 20s and 30s and 40s. Plus, I'm financially stable now, own a home. I'll be able to spend some serious time with my son as we both get a little older. Plus, he writes, when I stop changing his diapers, he can start changing mine. Oh, gosh. And then a last one here to your point, Judith, about, Emily writes, she says, I put off childbearing because I was waiting for job stability. I'll be having our first child about the week after our 12th anniversary. I'll be 35, my husband 36. I have no job. I'm in the middle of switching careers. She says, with a better economy and actual gender equality and family-friendly business policy, I think more people would have kids earlier. There are massive pressures to stay and establish yourself in a career. You get criticized for going out on your pathetically short 6 to 8 week maternity leave. Our society is broken on a lot of levels. I mean, Judith, there are reasons people are waiting.
Right. That's exactly what my piece is about. The careers that women move into if they want to move into the middle class or move up from the middle class to the upper middle class were designed for families in which a man was working and a woman was staying at home taking care of the kids. So it doesn't matter that the most intense hurdles that a person has to pass to stay in that career and rise in that career come when someone's in their 20s or 30s, because, they weren't taking care of kids and sort of going over those hurdles at the same time. Now, men and women have to go through these hurdles at a time when both men and women are expected to contribute to childcare, to sort of holding together a family. But of course, women pay the bigger price now, and as they did before. So what I'm asking for is a way of rethinking the workplace so that it isn't penalized financially and socially for taking time off. There could be furloughs. There could be guaranteed paid maternal and paternal leaves. Mm-hmm. Right now, if a man, in many workplaces, if a man takes a paternity leave, he's laughed at. He may be fired for not being serious enough. So there's all these social pressures on women and men to put it off. I would like that to change.
On your way to that argument, though, you're shaking up this idea that waiting is cost-free, which seems to have kind of been the message that's been put out there one way or another, that, have kids in your 20s or later, doesn't matter. And you're saying, well, wait a minute. It might. It does.
It does. It matters to the children, I think. I think the people who are paying for our delay are the children. They are more likely to have neurological problems. They are likely to have to care for much older parents. And I think it's going to be hard on them. And it's increasingly looking like it might be hard on societies where the age of first birth is delayed in the sense of declining fertility.
Judith Shilovitz, please stand by in New York. I want to bring a couple of other voices in here. Elizabeth Gregory joins us right now from Houston, Texas. She's director of Women's Studies Program at the University of Houston, author of Ready, Why Women Are Embracing the New Later Motherhood. Elizabeth Gregory, thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
It's great to have you with us. And with us from New York is Nona Willis Aronowitz. She's an adult child of older parents. She's 28. Her father's 79. Her mother died at 64. Her mother was 42, and mother and father was 51 when she was born. Nona, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Tom.
You've lived it from the child's side all the way to adulthood now. Judith says children may pay a price here. What did your experience tell you, Nona?
Well, I have a really ambivalent experience. I had a great childhood. My parents were a lot older than most of the kids that were, in my classes, and they were doing much better financially. They had really admirable careers that I could look up to. They had so much more time for me. They were so much less harried. I felt, even though I was a little embarrassed about how old they were because it wasn't as common as it is now, I was still secretly really happy that they had so much time. And granted, mm-hmm. I was an only child. Mm-hmm. I had other older half-siblings that my dad had much earlier, and I seem to have gotten the better deal.
Sounds like all sunshine so far.
Yeah. But now, my mother passed away at admittedly an earlier age than life expectancy.
64. How old were you then, Nona, when she passed?
I was 22. I was mm-hmm. just out of college. Mm-hmm. So that was a jolt to our familial system. Now my dad is 79, and he's a very vivacious 79. He also has long-term health care insurance because he's, upper middle class. Mm-hmm. He's a professor. Mm-hmm. But there are certain intangible things. His body is not, a 55-year-old body. It's somebody who's a senior citizen. I definitely find myself helping him out in small ways and big. I feel kind of weird, leaving New York permanently now that he's approaching his 80s.
Because he may just need your close help.
Exactly. And I think I'm happy to do it in some ways because this is an intimate experience, sort of like starting to care for an older person.
But you're only 28. We don't think of it showing up then.
Right. I mean, I feel as if I don't have as much freedom as some of my peers to pick up and leave or, concentrate on my career maybe as much as I want to. He really doesn't need my help in certain ways, but if I leave, for instance, for 3 weeks, I feel, all worried that he's going to call with some emergency. He had, a back operation a couple mm-hmm. years ago. That was a real strain on him. So that's always in the back of my mind.
So there's cost on the other end. Elizabeth Gregory, you celebrated later parenting. And you point out that very prominent women, Hillary Clinton, was 32 when she had Chelsea, Laura Bush, 35 when her twins arrived, Michelle Obama had her babies, famous daughters in the White House, at 34 and 37. And you've been kind of celebrating this, Elizabeth. What about this idea of a cost at the other end? How do you balance this picture?
There are definitely trade-offs, and I'm I agree that there's a dynamic that's a sort of, I would attribute it to the phenomenon itself, that we are now at the point where we can discuss family-friendly policies. It's only because women have delayed that they've gotten us to the point where they now have the kind of cultural weight and the money and the access. There are now a high of 20% women in Congress. There are more women in business positions to decide business policy. All of these discussions have only evolved because of delay. And it's never been a goal in itself for women. It's always been a kind of shadow benefit system, a kind of workaround, because women, long before people started doing studies to verify that it was true, noticed that every year of delay leads to a 12% gain in income in overall earnings. And, you know, that means that you have, if you delay, you have time to climb up the ladder into a position where you can stay for the long term or continue to climb. But you wouldn't have that access if you started your family later in the situation that we're in, because it's so family unfriendly.
So this is a kind of feminist argument that this later childbearing was part of the, are you saying it's kind of part of a price that has had to be paid to get women in a position of power, income, and all the rest, where they may change our social policies ultimately?
Yes, and I think that no one would disagree that control of fertility has had a huge influence on women's change status in society, because, you know, if people were having children as soon as they started having sex, they never were educated, they never had a chance to be part of the public sphere. So that's a change that's happened over the past 200 years, really the past 100 years. But, you know, in large part since the beginning of the pill in 1960, when people started delaying in order to get an education first, they were still having children, but they were having them a little later. And when we talk about delay, we're talking about a huge spread. I interviewed more than 100 women who had had their first child by birth or adoption at or after 35. But you're talking about also people who are starting now, or like Nona's dad, at 51 or even later. So there's a wide range of issues associated with somebody starting at 35 and somebody starting at 65.
Well, yeah, and we should be clear. You lay out some of these numbers. I mean, the average U.S. woman, and men are part of this too, of course, but the woman starts her family now at 25.2 years of age, up from 21.4 in 1970. College-educated women, that's been over 30 years, the average, for several years now. But these, births to older moms, you write, have been rising for years, 10 times as many first births to women 35, 39 in 06 as in 75, 13 times as many births to women 40 to 44 years old. These are spikes up in age, Elizabeth.
And they are actually, those are statistics from 2007. Mm-hmm. That book first came out right at the month that the downturn began. And between 2007 and 2011, the birth rate has fallen hugely, but it's been largely among women 15 to 25. The birth rate among teenagers fell 25%. So a lot of the discussion of the fall in, you know, the birth
demographic, baby bust,
it's about young women delaying because they figured out they need to wait. And it's a class elevator. It means their children will be in a much better situation. It's not a sign of declining, you know, workforce of the future. In fact, it means that the mothers will be more educated workers, and so will their children when they come to bear them at a point when they feel ready. That was the reason the name of my book is Ready, because people told me over and over again they felt ready. I'm also interested in this new interest in male infertility, which is a new realization that people have had, that men have these issues too.
Sure.
But, you know, so there are issues to do with genetic errors. But male infertility, which was a big part, I think, of Judith's discussion, because it's new data and it's very interesting, is so much easier to address than female infertility.
What, and you mean people just freeze sperm early and have it? Is that what you mean or something else?
Multiple ways. One, you could use your nephews. You could use your younger brothers. You could use a sperm donor in a way that is completely not similar to the what women
use
have
your
to go
nephews?
Through.
I'm not following. You mean you have a sperm donor step in? Is that what you're suggesting?
Well, that's what women do all the time, but they do it at huge hormonal baths they have to take to queue up with the egg donor's hormones. You know, I think what Judith was talking about was that there's this huge unregulated test that we're doing on people by giving them all these drugs. That doesn't obtain from men. If they decided they also wanted to use donor sperm, they would have no problem finding it, and it wouldn't involve any hormones.
Of course, it's a pretty big step. I mean, that makes, you know, that puts somebody else's genes in the line. And okay, people do it. Women do it all the time. All kinds of people do it, but it's not like, it's not such a casual decision. But before we go to that, if I may, Judith, what about this idea that later childbearing for women, men are half of this equation, but for women, it maybe has been the price of empowerment?
I couldn't agree more. I think Elizabeth is absolutely right. We had to take control of our fertility before we could move into the universities and into the managerial class. But now, as she says, we're in a position to start discussing changing society so that we don't have to make these difficult choices. So I advocate changing society so that women have more choices. They could start younger if they wanted, and they wouldn't be penalized to the degree, in terms of income, to the degree that Elizabeth said, where they wouldn't be losing, you know, 12% of their income every year. They pushed it forward instead of back.
I mean, I don't know when that change is coming. Yeah, Nona, do you have kids yet? Is it happening for you?
No, but I do think the reasons for my generation waiting are different than the reasons that my mom waited. She waited because you really did have to choose between having a child and having a career. But nowadays, both men and women my age don't feel as if we could afford it at all, especially downwardly mobile middle-class kids who want to give the same opportunities to their kids as they had. We're thinking, okay, well, we have to wait until we have a good salary. Not only women, but also our dudes.
Yeah.
They're in the same boat.
Yeah. Elizabeth, I'm not sure that, you know, the economy and our policy are catching up with this train.
Well, we'll see. I mean, it's supposed to be turning around. I actually think that putting in a national childcare system would be a jobs engine. First of all, there would be a lot of jobs that people would have to fill to do this work. Mm-hmm. And you would have many more people free to work. And you would also raise the questions that Nona's raising about, you know, people having to figure out, do I want to have children now? Is it simply an issue of can I afford it? Or in which case I would do it if I could afford it? Or are there all these other issues that are also associated with delay and that women have identified as positive? There's actually been happiness studies associated with early childbearing as opposed to later childbearing. People are much happier if they start later than if they start earlier. People in the middle are sort of in the middle. But people will have to, deal with issues found the right partner. Well, it takes people a while to find the right partner.
I mean, that's all there, but Judith is suggesting that they may be happier, but it's in part because they're turning a blind eye to a bunch of eventual costs, or maybe not so eventual costs, to that later childbearing.
Well, there is the issue of grandparents, which I think is, you know, a very important issue in people's lives. Lots of people don't see their grandparents because they live nowhere near them. Mm-hmm. So it's not less of an issue for those people. Some people, you know, the dynamic of later motherhood itself and the death of the mother, the statistics are actually pretty good for later moms, on average, mm-hmm. not for each individual, because later moms live longer than people who've started having their children earlier. So that's a handy side effect.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about America's wave of older parents and what having kids late means for family life and for our society. Judith Shulevitz is with us from The New Republic. Elizabeth Gregory, author of Ready. Nona Willis Aronowitz, journalist and author, is with us. Let's go right to our many callers here. Maria, Lexington, Massachusetts. Maria, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I started my family at the age of 39, so I'm 49. I have a 10-year-old. I had my children at 39, 40, and 45.
Okay.
And sometimes I think to myself, I'm way too old to have a 4-year-old running around the house. But
could be your grandchild in a different age.
Well, actually, when I told my husband that I was pregnant with our now 4-year-old, he said, "Oh, I'm going to be a grandfather."
He was
55 at the time.
Well, there you go. Okay, right.
Yeah, but, you know, just a quick point about the grandparents. You know, don't forget, people didn't live as long a long time ago. So when I grew up, I didn't know either of my grandfathers. They had both passed away.
Mm-hmm.
My kids have gotten to know my parents, who are still alive, got to know my husband's parents a little bit before they passed away. My youngest did not get to meet my husband's parents. But, you know, my parents are in my kids' lives. The disadvantage is that I have a lot of friends who are younger that have kids, and they'll go away for the weekend and leave the kids with the grandparents.
Right.
I can't do that. My parents are in their 80s.
Right.
So I just don't have that option.
Yeah, there
so
it
I
is.
Find, like, yeah, I've never been away from my kids.
So on balance, I mean, maybe for a parent, once you've done it, there is no on balance. It's just your reality. But if you were starting over, Maria.
My feeling is, though, I didn't even think I wanted to have kids. My husband, I met him later in life. You know, he sort of talked me into it, and I actually left a six-figure income to stay home with my kids, which I was able to do because he was making enough money for me to do that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there are so many positives. I would never have had the patience that I have with my kids now. And I also have, I live in Lexington. It's a huge, I mean, this town is sports, and, you know, there's a lot of activities for kids, and I've actually opted to say, I don't want my kids in all these activities. And I think if I were younger, I mean, I feel the pressure. People say to me, what, your kids aren't doing this, they're not doing that. And I think 10 years ago or 15 years ago, I probably would have just put them in everything. And because I'm older, I'm like, you know what, time is short. I want to spend time with my kids. And they're home with me every day after school. They come home, they do their homework. I think I'm a much different parent than someone who's in their 20s or even 30s.
Who might want to be out there at the soccer field night and day. I appreciate your call, Maria. I mean, Judith, buried in there, Maria's, you know, you hear her story. But one of the things is this idea that, you know, 50 is the new 30, 60 is the new 40, and so on. So it doesn't matter. So you can wait because... But I'm not sure when people actually arrive at those ages of 50 and 60 and 70 that they feel 30 and 40 and 50 instead, Judith.
I mean, first of all, she's absolutely right that, you know, someone born in the 1880s had a pretty slim chance of knowing their grandparents because people have died much earlier.
Sure, yeah.
But I agree with you that even though people are living longer, the quality of life is not always high in that last quarter of life. And it's much harder for grandparents to do what they used to be able to do, at least in the 20th century, at least when I was growing up. And, you know, and since they are a crucial source of support, it is harder to leave your children with. I can't do it either. I can't leave my children with my parents or my in-laws because they're in no position to take care of them. I agree that I am much more mature than I was. I do think that some of the stress that younger parents feel is the stress of establishing themselves in careers and dealing with hostile workplaces. And if that stress were alleviated, they might be able to enjoy their children the way older parents do.
Nona, did you know any of your grandparents, Nona?
I knew three out of the four of them, and it wasn't because... The fourth one died before I was even born early of a heart attack. But they all had their kids in their 20s. My grandmother was 19 when she had my dad. She just died a year and a half ago.
Yeah. Okay.
So I actually did know them, and it was great. But it was only because they had chosen to have their kids much younger.
I mean,
and you know, they were. And in the case of my mom's mom, she was a housewife, so she was in this very, you know, 50s organization of one person stays at home and the other person kills themselves at work for decades.
Right. I mean, Elizabeth, you know, in my grandparents were very important in my childhood. I really can't imagine it without them. They were just huge figures and very, very present, working on the farm and everything else. In my in-laws, you know, the women in that family had babies in three generations at, I think, age 18 and then 19 and then my wife in her 20s. So we had lots of multi-generational years, which were kind of a joyous thing. That is not part of this picture. It can't be when you spread it out so much, Elizabeth.
Well, it varies by family, according to story. And
but if you start in your 30s, you're not going to have great-grandmothers around. If you start in your 40s, forget about it.
That's true. And one of the dynamics of families of old, of course, was that people started in their teens and 20s and they continued into their 40s. So there were some members of the family who didn't know the grandparents because they were in a different generation, effectively.
Right.
But now, it's true, you do have a different kind of generational spread. And in fact, you could say that you're your own grandpa, you know, your children's own grandpa or grandma. Because you sort of represent the world that would have been generationally in terms of handing on family lore. Well, you have it. You have the same lore that the grandmother would have had if you were 20, when you know, if you see what I mean.
You've got the power. You've got the lore. Amy in Shinglehaus, Pennsylvania. Amy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks.
Hi. Yeah.
I am a 43-year-old child of older parents. They were 40 when they had me in 1969, which was very odd back then.
Okay.
So I always had the oldest parents of all of my friends.
How do you feel about it?
I actually really enjoyed it. I know a lot more old movies and old music than my friends do. My dad is a huge Glenn Miller fan, okay. So I am too.
Right. That's and, funny. You were retro before retro was in.
I totally was. And they are still around, and we see them frequently. I have 5 kids. And they know their grandparents, and they really enjoy them. They love talking to them. So I think on the whole, it was positive. I'm not able to help my parents as much as I would like to because we do live a little bit of a distance from them, and we have a farm, so it's hard to get away sometimes. But I do have an older brother who lives with them and is able to help them. So, you know, I feel fortunate for that.
So that works, and it sounds like it worked out pretty well for you. It's a fond experience. You know Glenn Miller when nobody else in your age knew Glenn Miller. Amy, I appreciate that. Let me get one more. Annie in North Andover, Massachusetts. Annie, you're on.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah.
I'm also approaching 40, and my father was 40 when I was born. And I have to say I had a very different experience. My father, I was very aware of the fact that he was very much older than my friend's fathers. He was not doing the soccer coaching, baseball coaching. He wasn't up for it. He had his first heart attack when I was 3 years old.
Yeah.
Which is young, but I was very, very aware of this. And he had previous children who he had when he was younger. And I was very aware of the fact that I felt like they got a better dad.
So what are you going to do, Annie, in your own childbearing, if you have a choice about it?
I left a career in science research because I didn't see a way to have my children at what I thought would be a better age and continue that career. So I left and I had my children my first daughter when I was 28.
My guests say we need public policy changes and that empowered women who went on with their careers are now getting to positions where they maybe can deliver that through our political system. What do you think? Is it going to happen?
I can't see. I mean, I can see that in some cases that would work, but I can't see in the way science research, which was my experience, is done now, that one could have a family life and do that unless the entire field were seriously reconstructed. In my lab of perhaps 15 people, including the principal investigator, one of us had a child, and that soon after the child was born, she ended up divorced because she couldn't manage all of it together.
Annie, let us pick it up right there if we may. Judith, there's a little implication that maybe we're dreaming if we think we can restructure in such a way that we can make everything possible here.
We may be in this country. It's going to be a long time, but I say you have to dream. You have to think about it. Science education is expensive. It takes a long time. So society invested quite a lot in Annie's education, and it's really a tragedy that she had to leave and not be able to continue to work in science. We desperately need more people, more women, but more people in general with science degrees. You know, we're filling our graduate schools with people brought in from other countries because we can't generate enough. So there's a really powerful argument in terms of productivity and innovation in this country for making science a more family-friendly field, making it possible to juggle the two.
But how do you that? Just for one example, I mean, we're always told, you know, most scientists make their biggest contributions by the time they're, I don't know what it is, you know, 29 years old or something.
I mean, that's true in some fields and less true in others. Mm-hmm. But make it possible for that woman to work fewer hours, have a national child care system, guarantee that she can leave and come back at the same level and at the same level of pay after a certain time. Just don't make it an either-or choice. It's ridiculous to invest the amount of money we do in women's education and then have them drop out.
But people are out there dealing with the realities right now, and as Annie did, found, you know, she just couldn't make it happen. She didn't want to repeat that late parenting experience, so she's gone off those rails, and she's into parenting. Let me get another. Josh in Charlestown, Rhode Island. Josh, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Basically, I just wanted to call and say, you know, I'm 26 years old, and my wife and I have been together for, we've been together for 9 years, married for one, and, you know, we're at this weird point where I have an opportunity to advance in my career, but that would be totally impossible by having kids. You know, the hours just wouldn't present themselves to be conducive to have kids. And on top of that, you know, I work in a school system where, you know, it's 16 to 24-year-olds, and a lot of them are low income. And I see all the trials and tribulations that they go through when they have kids at a young age. And, you know, I'm personally helping them get through some of those times and some of those stresses. And it seems virtually impossible for anyone, at least under the age of 30, with a very established career, to be even considering having kids right now.
But here's Judith laying out all these reasons that it might make good sense, that you may pay a price if you wait. And your response to that is what, Josh?
Just, you know, to deal with everything that you're dealing with now and trying to build yourself a career, it just seems like it wouldn't make sense. It would be an uphill battle the entire time. Like, I know that raising a kid is definitely a challenge, and it comes with all of its own challenges, but at what point do you have to decide, okay, is this going to be way too much work, or is this going to be something that's going to be more harmful than it is good to a child?
Josh,
I feel you.
Nona's right there. Nona, where are you on this? You're 28. What's your plan?
Well, when I wrote this piece in the Washington Post about my feelings about having older parents, I said that if I had all the institutional support, I might want to have a child. But as of now, I feel the same way as Josh, that I do see the downsides to being an older parent, but I see more downsides being a younger parent at this point.
Institutional
30 is not the same as 26. I mean,
well, 28
isn't the same as 35.
Right.
But I mean, there are a lot of differences between each, you know, a few years forward. So if Josh waits a few years, he'll be in a better position to make a decision that won't have anything to do with the issues that Judith is raising. So she's raising questions for people in their 40s and late 30s, but his situation is different. So, you know, there's so
still
many different factors.
Still a good window there, you're saying.
Nobody should tell somebody when to make a decision, but when they're thinking about it, they shouldn't think that any delay is the same as extended delay. There's a whole range of effects across time, and the average age at which college-educated people have their first birth, women, is 30 and men is 32, and that's across races. So it's to do with people putting in the time, getting their degree, establishing at work, finding the right partner. Sounds like Josh has the right partner. But you know, it's a class elevator. So wherever you start out, if you're a middle class person, you know, people say this is a middle class phenomenon, but it's frequently a case of people who started off in a lower class and put in the time to go get their education.
Yeah.
And then they end up having middle class children. So there are a lot of basic
It's a good investment you're saying
that people
there.
Make.
But Judith, so if the average is 30 for college-educated Americans for the first child, does that look okay to you, Judith, or is that already too late on the escalator? That's
no,
the first
I don't
child.
Think it's too late. I think Elizabeth is absolutely right. It's age 35 that fertility starts to decline, and by 40, it's really steeply down.
But I mean, 30 is just the first child, not the second
right.
or the third or, you know— Keep
but
counting.
It's not quite so far down as people think.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, at 35, about 11% of women are infertile and unable to have a child without assistance. And actually, in terms of who uses IVF, only about 10% of the women over 40 have employed IVF. And a large percent of those are people who used egg donors successfully. You know, there are others who have tried it and it hasn't worked. But in terms of the actual births, only about 10% of the births to women over 40 employ IVF, and only about 5% of the women in the 35 to 39 age range, and that's more than 600,000 births, are involve IVF. They may involve Clomid or some other, but you know, we're still not to the point where we equal the number of births to women in their late 30s and 40s in the baby boom, when people were having them, just kept started early and kept having them. So it's not really the fertility issue that people represented. It does start to decline, and by the time you're 40, only about 2/3 of women can have child without aid, and by 41, only a half, and after that, sharply declines. But people say 35 as though that were the fertility cliff, you know, like the fiscal cliff. You're just going to fall off it. That's not the experience that most people have.
Though what it takes to operate in that zone, Judith Shulevitz is raising some questions about in this piece. Judith, you ask for policy changes. Is there an attitude change toward later parenthood that you're asking for here as well?
Yes, I am. I definitely am. And I think that that attitude has to come from the workplace, from employers, from government. It's because it's those institutions that are going to make it possible. And I do have to say that a lot of questions are being raised about Clomid now that I think are important. When you're 35, doctors start handing out Clomid sort of rather freely, and it's a very strong drug.
Lots of big issues here for family and our society. Judith Shulevitz raises them very well in The New Republic. Judith, thank you so much for being with us this hour. And Elizabeth Gregory, author of Ready, Nona Willis Aronowitz, who's written in The Washington Post. Thanks to all of you very much, and listeners as well. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.